thank you very much. They call it Super Tuesday for a reason.
As he barrels towards the 2024 Republican nomination, former President Donald Trump has made clear what a return to the White House would mean.
For those who have been wronged and betrayed, I am your retribution. I am your retribution.
I'm Margaret Hoover. This is a special edition of the Firing Line podcast, recorded before a student audience at Hofstra University. I was joined by two conservatives with opposing views on Trump's record in office and his ambitions for the future. Mike Gonzalez, a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation.
Look at the Trump years. We had a great economy, very low inflation. We had a tax cut that worked. We had peace in the world. Americans were not under threat.
And Amanda Carpenter, a former aide to Senator Ted Cruz.
Donald Trump was constrained by people in his administration the first time around. A lot of people supporting Donald Trump's second term view that as a problem.
Gonzalez is one of the architects of Project 2025, a proposed agenda for the next conservative president that would reshape the federal government.
We need to return power to the people. People who are in the permanent bureaucracy should not be in policymaking.
Carpenter co-authored a report detailing how another Trump term could decimate American democracy.
When Donald Trump says, you know, I have the Article II power to do whatever I want, you are talking about a different view of executive power.
And the students got a chance to voice their concerns about the direction of the country.
Do you think that Trump's role in these polarized politics are something that's going to last in a post-Trump America?
Amanda Carpenter, Mike Gonzalez, welcome to Firing Line. We're here at Hofstra University in front of a studio audience of students. And we're here to discuss what a second term with Donald Trump as president could mean to American democracy and to the American conservative movement. You both have a history in Republican politics. Amanda, you previously worked for Senator Ted Cruz of Texas and Senator Jim DeMint of South Carolina, who at one time was also the president of the Heritage Foundation, a nonpartisan conservative think tank that you, Mike Gonzalez, work for now. You're both former journalists. Mike, you worked in George W. Bush's administration. Today, you find yourselves on different sides of the question and different places politically about what former President Trump has done, both to the country and to the GOP. For both of you, I'd like to know, has Donald Trump changed the Republican Party for better or for worse? Mike.
Yes, has changed it, I think, for the better. But first, I should say that I'm speaking in my own capacity, that I'm speaking for Heritage, nor for the Washington Examiner, for which I'm a weekly columnist, nor for Encounter, my publisher, not even for the Gonzalez family. All five of us have different views. I'm here speaking my mind.
Yeah.
Obviously, this is a very different party today than it was, that, you know, 10 years ago. It's more attuned to the demands, the angsts, the worries of the people. There's a long answer to this, which I don't want to give you, of the Democratic Party, or the left in general, abandoning the working class, because the working class turned out to be not very good revolutionaries. They just wanted better conditions. And now the chickens have come home to roost, and the people, the everyday, what is generally, I think, mistakenly called the common man. There's nothing common about the common man. I prefer to say everyday Americans. They have worries and wants that are different from those of the East, the Northeastern elite, the coastal elites, and I think Donald Trump has changed the Republican Party to be more responsive to that.
Amanda, from your perspective, and you're speaking in your personal capacity, has Donald Trump changed the Republican Party for the better or for worse?
I mean, from my point of view, there's no question he'd change it for the worse. And even just looking at the plain politics of the lack of success the Republican Party has had, I mean, he won by a very slim margin in 2016, losses in 2018 midterms, loss in 2020, and losses in the 22 midterms. But, you know, I don't like to just focus on the politics because I don't believe you should just do what will lead you to win. The way that he has changed the Republican Party to have a broad, unconstrained view of power that puts Donald Trump above the law is really what worries me long term. The way I see the 2024 election. This really isn't a question of Donald Trump versus Joe Biden. It's a question of that we have really grappled with throughout Donald Trump's presidency of how we hold the president accountable. We're looking at a president that was impeached twice. Somehow, he has the Republican nomination for the third straight election in a row. I mean, if you feel exhausted by the prospect of 2024, remind yourself that this is the third time Donald Trump has been on the ballot for the Republican Party in three straight elections. I mean, there's something that's just fundamentally unhealthy about a party that has such losses. I mean, plain L's on the board and doesn't find a new way to get new growth, new ideas, and new blood into the party. But really, it's the way he's campaigning. I was, you know, very much against Trump since his 2016 campaign because I do believe that a way a candidate campaigns indicates how he will govern. And, you know, might disagree with me, but I think it's very clear that he campaigned in conspiracies and lies. I had a front seat of that. You know, working for CNN, I was supporting Ted Cruz at the time. And then he went on to govern with conspiracies and lies. And what really concerns me now, in the 2024 election, he launched his campaign in Waco, Texas, which is a symbol for a lot of, you know, extremist, militia actors. I don't think that was an accident. And he said in plain words, "I am your retribution. Elect me and I will, you know, have retribution on people." I don't even want to say political enemies, because you don't have to do anything necessarily wrong to be singled out by a Donald Trump government. And he has all the plans to do this, some of which I think, you know, Heritage was on the wrong side in supporting. And you just have to look at a second term with Donald Trump. It won't be like the first term because he knows how to use the levers of power the second time. The things that he is promising on the campaign trail, saying, "I will investigate my enemies. I will go after people I don't like." He's has an apparatus around him where they've thought about how to make his rhetoric into a reality. The second time, there won't be accidents. It will happen because he's committed to surrounding himself with loyalists who are committed to him and not the fundamental principles of the rule of law.
Okay, 74 million people voted for Donald Trump in 2020. Republicans are going to be grappling with this question again. Do we vote for a Donald Trump? When they read for him last time, there was January 6th hadn't happened. There hadn't been violence at the Capitol. There hadn't been a first ever attempt to perhaps not peacefully exchange power, transition of power. So I think the question Republicans who voted for him last time will be asking themselves is, I might be uncomfortable with Trump, but is he still better than Biden? And this is what I want to get at. Let me play this video for you first. Take a look.
"We will treat those people from January 6th fairly. We will treat them fairly. And if it requires pardons, we will give them pardons. I am your warrior. I am your justice. And for those who have been wronged and betrayed, I am your retribution. I am your retribution. We will root out the communists, Marxists, fascists, and the radical left thugs that live like vermin within the confines of our country."
He says, "You're not going to be a dictator, are you?" I said, "No, no, no, other than day one."
Your reaction?
I disagree with a lot of what you said, Amanda, in that he has expanded the party. You talked about Waco. I go to the Rio Grande Valley. Trump improved his performance from 2016 to 2020 by 30 percentage points in each county, 40 percentage points. He won Zapata County outright, the first Republican to do so. And these are counties that are 92% Mexican-American. He's likely to do better with the cohort of Americans that I think is wrongly lumped together as Hispanics, because I think that's a wrong denomination. He's going to do much better than any Republican before him, even Nixon, likely, if the polls are right. So I think that he has brought new blood. He has expanded the party.
How will you persuade Republicans who have some hesitations about Donald Trump, especially in response to some of the clips that they've heard, to support him?
Well, it's not my job to do that. I'm not here defending the candidate.
But you haven't,
I'm not here defending the candidate, nor his personality, nor the fact that he is, you know, he's more personal than I would like, or none of that. I'm here discussing his policies, and I think you touched on a good point. It's Trump versus Biden. And I think you have to look at what a Trump 2.0 and a Biden 2.0 would be. And we have to be frank with each other. We have a government report that now says that the president has diminished faculties, that he could not be brought in front of a jury because the jury could not convict him because he is an elderly old man, an elderly man with faulty memory, with poor memory. And, you know, can Biden discharge the many responsibilities of his office? This recently, ABC News had a poll. You know how many people think he's too old to run for president? 86%.
But let's stick with the policies.
No, right. Okay, fine. I'm very happy to do that. The policies have been awful. The policies, the border has been open. The foreign policy, the world is on fire. If they promised to bring the adults in charge of foreign policy, if these are the adults, we need to call social services. This is, you know, we have two hot wars, one about to maybe start between China and Taiwan. And I got news for you. Venezuela, Maduro is maybe about to invade Guyana. His weakness is provocative. And domestic policy was also very bad. We have inflation, such as we haven't had in decades. And look at the Trump years. The Trump years, whatever his rhetoric was, I'm not here to discuss his rhetoric. We're talking 3 years versus 3 years. We had a great economy, very low inflation. We had a tax cut that worked. We had peace in the world. Americans were not under threat. I think that on the basis of this, if we indeed have a Biden 2.0, which looks increasingly unlikely, but we can, if we can think that we are going to have a Biden 2.0, we can discuss the policies of Trump in the first 3 years and the policies of Biden in the first 3 years. And I think that's a very easy debate to have.
Okay. Amanda, I want to go to you, and I know you want to respond to what Mike said. I want to let you do that. But I also want to point out that you work for an organization called Protect Democracy, which has recently published a paper called The Authoritarian Playbook 2025. And it details in many different chapters how specifically a second Trump administration could dismantle democracy. Many on the right have dismissed this as alarmism. Mm-hmm. Why are you so concerned? And you got to this a little bit earlier, but I want to really unpack it now. Why are you so concerned that a second Trump term would be different than the first?
Sure. Let's start with the idea, because this is a popular one you come across a lot, that you can separate Donald Trump's rhetoric and have a debate about the policies. And I sort of reject that outhand, because what Donald Trump is proposing is remaking the government in a different way so that you can't have a legitimate policy debate. I mean, we're not talking about policy preferences. When Donald Trump says, you know, I have the Article II power to do whatever I want, you were talking about a different view of executive power. You know, we can have a debate about that, but that's not using that as a means to getting your policy preferences. That is a different way of running the federal government. And so you look at his other promises that you pointed out in that video reel, where he's talking about giving pardons to January 6th rioters. This is one, you know, big red flag area. What you were talking about in pardoning the rioters, if he is elected president and does that, that effectively amounts to a license for political violence that he approves of. You know, that should be, you know, a
red line. Your argument is that people would then be incentivized to pursue Donald Trump's agenda, knowing that they won't be held accountable by the law.
Sure. And so, you know, when someone says, I have Article II power to do whatever I want, you are saying that I will not be constrained by the law. I'm the president. Then this isn't just like offhand rhetoric. He's actually making versions of this in court right now, where he's saying, because I was president, whatever I did when I was president, I am immune.
And that has been turned down.
He's making it in court because that is what he believes. Okay. And so if you're elected president, who's going to stop them? We keep saying, you know, there's this other popular idea that the institutions are strong enough to hold President Trump. Well, not if Congress won't hold him accountable, not if he doesn't respect judicial rulings, like he didn't respect any of the judicial rulings that said there was no widespread fraud in the 2020 election. He continues to promote the lie that the election was stolen. And so I ask, what will constrain him in a second Trump term if none of those guardrails are present? Because to me, by my close reading of it, of how he views and how he plans to remake the federal government, to have stronger control over the executive agencies and all these staff that promote this worldview to get the policies they want, they're willing to trade all these ideas of limited executive power to get the policies they want. And let me tell you what, this is the authoritarian endgame. This is what happens in all authoritarian regimes. They consolidate all this executive power, and then guess what? You can't give it up. Because if your political adversaries ever get it, they might hold you accountable. And then they stay in power and they never get out.
Mike, you're of Cuban descent. You have spent much of your career actually focused on authoritarianism abroad. You're one of the authors for the Mandate for Leadership 2025, this 900-page guidebook that articulates the policies of a next conservative president, which is part of Heritage Foundation's Project 2025. Now, I should say the Heritage Foundation is a 501c3 nonprofit conservative think tank and will not be endorsing any candidate in the presidential race.
Right. These are political ideas that we would love for President Biden to take up, for any president, the next president, this president, to take up. These are ideas that we gathered 80 conservative groups, not just the Heritage Foundation, and we put them in a book. And so this is really policy formulations, which is really what we do.
And you do it every 4 years?
Yeah.
Right.
We've done it since Ronald Reagan, yeah.
Okay. Mandate for Leadership delineates many areas of the federal government that would be overhauled and reformed in a second Trump administration. Why do you believe such dramatic action is needed?
We need to return power to the people. There is no fourth branch of government in the Constitution. Right now, we have a permanent bureaucracy that is 2.4 million strong. And you know, we cannot have elected officials be stymied, sabotaged by people who think it is their right to govern. People who are in the permanent bureaucracy should not be in policymaking. So I am very strongly of the belief that we have to get that under control. That is not authoritarian, Amanda. And it's very rich for a side that wants to drive, you know, Dean Phillips of Minnesota off the ballot, that wants to drive RFK Jr. off the ballot. He's being investigated. The DNC is now asking the FCC to investigate him. That is pursuing and persecuting the guy who's leading the other party with lawfare, you know, the one to indict him, maybe put him in prison, deny the people the right to vote for him. It is rich for that side to say, we're standing up for democracy. The weaponization of the DOJ, you talk about political violence. What were you in all of 2020? We had political violence for months.
Yeah,
we had 12,000 demonstrations.
You're referring to the summer.
The BLM riots of 2020. Yes,
Black Lives Matter, which you have written extensively
right.
about, and you're referring to the summer of 2020 where George Floyd
right.
was murdered and the riots across the country.
So we had a crisis monitor based in Princeton that has coded 630 riots. When people say, yeah, most of the demonstrations were peaceful, that's true, but there were 12,000 demonstrations. 660, it's a small percentage of 12,000, but it's still a lot of riots. And we had $2 billion in damage. We have people who lost their lives. The country has been changed dramatically because that was political violence. That was political violence by people who had an agenda, and that lasted for months.
Yeah, and the people that broke the law should, you know, serve the punishment, not be pardoned.
If I may, though, hold on, because I want to keep this on Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. Mike, I'd like you to take on the concern Amanda expresses about the rhetoric, which is easily dismissed by many people as just rhetoric, and the real actions that President Trump has demonstrated he's willing to take when things don't go his way.
I don't understand the willing to take. We have the 3 years.
I'm just looking at January 6th. January 6th, where he was unwilling to peaceably leave office without sending or instigating a group of people to go to the Capitol and attack the Capitol. Why is it just rhetoric, and why shouldn't that rhetoric be taken slightly differently now?
So I'm not sure there's any part of that speech in which he instigated the crowd to attack the Capitol. He said, march peacefully and patriotically.
When Rudy Giuliani said death by combat, was that asking?
I am talking about Trump.
Okay, and that rally was where all of them were speaking.
And
trial, by the way, I'm sorry, he said trial by combat.
Yeah, I don't I think January 6th was awful. I think it was stomach churning. I think I'm with you and that the people who committed violence should be tried. I think some of the sentences have been overly, you know, some of them have been really long. I mean, 1,200 people have been accused of crimes. Nothing like that happened with the BLM riots, which lasted for months. That was really political. That was more of an insurrection. In the years that
were Trump, they overthrowing the federal government?
They were actually
violent action, because when I look at January 6th, I see concentrated action to stop the peaceful transfer of power and deny Biden's presidency.
They said they wanted to overthrow how America is constituted. They have, if you go back and see what the architects of BLM said, they actually said that. I want to overthrow the organizing principle of this society.
So what are you saying, that their leaders should be disqualified from office like Donald Trump? Because I would support
what
that.
What I'm saying is that you talk about political violence. We had that one day followed months of political violence. Let's not talk like it happened in a vacuum.
Why do they need to compare the two?
I'm going to take control of this, because I don't want to compare this to BLM. Here's what I want to talk about. I want to talk about, is a second Trump administration going to be a new coming and a reinvigoration of American conservatism and an opportunity to really install policies that can help define a new generation of conservatives? Or is it going to undermine the institutions of our democracy in a way that will undermine any of those proposed conservative policies? So I want to take it, I want to stay on a couple of just examples. Amanda, you write about how Trump plans to use the Alien Enemies Act of 1798 to remove non-citizens en masse without due process. Why is this of concern if he returns to office?
Well, foundationally, it's a concern because you're invoking warlike measures to exercise what is within the purview of federal and congressional immigration policy. And so why are we going to warlike measures rather than working with the existing structures? But first, I just want to rewind the tape back just a little bit, because the thing that underscores Donald Trump's new ethos for a second Trump term is just the idea of that he was stopped by the deep state, sabotaged by the deep state in his first term. And I actually don't think that's true. If you look at the big areas where his policies were stopped, it were by high-ranking conservative officials of his own appointment. I mean, if you want to talk about immigration policy, he went to his advisors and said things like, well, can't we just shoot them? And his advisor says, no, you can't, sir. They opposed him on that policy because not only was it just morally wrong to do, but it's outside the law.
Right.
And so now, going to a second Trump administration, they have people developing a framework so that you can do things like sweep people up, robust interior enforcement, using these warlike measures. They talk about how immigration is now an invasion at the border. That is all being used to trigger these Alien Enemies Act so that they can take these military-like operations, which I think is not something that is within unilateral executive power.
Mike, the document that the Heritage Foundation published does propose a vast expansion of expedited removals and new detention camps for families and children. It does not go as far as some of Trump's allies have suggested. How do you respond to Amanda's concerns about overreach, possible overreach in the second Trump administration by federal law enforcement related to immigration?
Well, I want to ask you a question. Mm-hmm. The 1798 Immigration Naturalization Act, is that the one you're referring to?
The Alien Enemies.
That was 1798, right?
It's 17 or 1703.
What war was that?
1798.
I mean, was that a warlike measure? A wartime measure? There wasn't any war at the time.
Why would we need to go back? You tell me. I mean, Heritage seems to support this as well. Kevin Cuccinelli wrote this document. He served in this administration. Invoking these measures so that we can massively expand resources at the Border Patrol, putting federal agencies, putting the military in this. I mean, this is all stuff supported by the Heritage Foundation.
I'm just saying that these are not wartime measures because there was no war then. Look,
the Alien and Sedition Acts. It was a law that was a subsidiary of the Alien and Sedition Acts, which were created at the.
But it was not a wartime measure. There was no war.
The Alien and Sedition Acts.
So, look, I don't know which question to ask. You asked whether
we're going to have... how do you respond to the... How do you respond to...
Why should Donald Trump have a war at the border?
How do you respond to concerns of overreach by federal law enforcement with respect to deportations
between
and immigration?
8 million and 10 million people, we don't know how many, have come in the past 3 years. The border is open. People are being paroled. And even Alejandro Mayorkas has said that 85% of people who come in and ask for asylum are allowed in. You know, we don't know what we're going to do with the population that has come in.
But with respect to the concern...
10 million people is bigger than 35 states.
No. There's no question there is a crisis on the border. This program has covered it. You have talked about it. You have both talked about it. We all agree there is a crisis on the border. But in terms of how to use the power of the executive to combat that crisis of the border, how do you respond to accusations that Trump would push the limits of executive power in order to deal with the border crisis?
I think the first thing he would do is close the border the way he did during his administration. We didn't have this crisis. This was willfully done by Biden. He came in as a candidate and said, I want to see a rush of the foreign-born to the border. He said that on the campaign trail. And it happened. Actually, people have rushed to the border. The border is a disgrace. It's open. I think that the border will go back to what we had, hopefully. And then we have to, what do we do with that population of 10 million people who have come in, who have been paroled in? You know, the definition of parole has been expanded. It was supposed to mean, it was very limited, allow in people who didn't have papers, allow in people who have to come in and testify at a trial. And then it was expanded enormously by the Biden administration to the point that we have 8 or 10 million people who have come in.
I absolutely grant you that. Amanda, do you understand the point he's making about the expansion of humanitarian parole in a way that hasn't actually reflected congressional action,
yeah,
but rather a reinterpretation of the statute in order to handle a political outcome?
You
understand his argument?
I think it would be wonderful if Congress actually did assert itself and start making some border policy. There was a deal on the table now, which I think was actually possibility for a big conservative victory. I moved to Washington in 2005. Trust me, it's been an immigration crisis every single summer since I've been involved in conservative politics. And this was the first time, the first deal where there was an actual amnesty separated from the agreement. This wasn't a comprehensive immigration deal that conservatives have, you know, opposed, you know, since 2006. At least in my memory, it was a border security first. And you would have got a shutdown at the border if it exceeded a certain cap. And so, but this is
5,000.
Okay, so guys,
this is where it gets into trouble. We're always looking to the present to just do everything. And I think a lot of Republicans in Congress stood down because they have this idea that if we just let Trump, we're just going to give him all the power.
Well, actually what happened is conservatives negotiated this bill, and then Donald Trump said he wasn't for it, and then it collapsed in 24 hours.
But Republicans did. But
hold on, guys. I want to actually, we're going in circles here. I want to put a pin in this one, and I want to move to the next one. Mike, I just want to give you one more chance to respond to President Trump's rhetoric about the overreach of the executive branch when it comes to dealing with the immigration crisis. How do you respond to that concern that Amanda raises?
We had a border that was stable under Trump. We had the Remain in Mexico policy.
But I'm talking about the concerns about overreach by Trump in a second administration.
But that didn't happen in the first administration.
So you're saying because it didn't happen in the first administration.
It didn't happen in the first one.
Okay.
We had a border that was not hermetically closed, but was reasonably closed. We didn't have the chaos we have today.
But how do you respond to the concerns he has raised about using federal forces to implement these mass deportations?
I think, I don't know what they're going to do, but we have a big problem. We have it now affecting northern cities. We have, who knows, maybe 10 million people have come in, larger than the population of many states that are roaming the country. I think it'd be good to just go back to, let's deal first, let's go back to closing the border the way Trump did during his 4 years in office. We had a border that was...
Are you confident he will do it completely legally within his executive authority, legal executive authority?
Well, that's the way he did it in his first 4 years.
Okay, so you can't... But I haven't heard you respond to the concern Amanda has raised. Is it just because you don't have a concern?
We have a crisis of a
border.
But
does that justify extra legal action?
I'm not sure that I, you know, to be honest, I don't know what he's promised to do, But I know that what we have right now is a chaotic border that's completely open, that, you know, maybe up to 10 million people have come in the first 3 years of the Biden administration. They're roaming the country. They have been allowed in. The border did not need to be open in this way. We have a crisis that now reached northern cities. This is a big crisis for the Biden administration, and they're realizing it finally.
Yeah, all of that is true. I think the question still is about whether Trump will be true to his word and implement the largest mass deportation operation in history using arcane laws from the founding of the country to remove non-citizens en masse without due process. And I'm not sure that we got to a place of understanding on that, but I want to move on to the Department of Justice. Project 2025 calls for reexamining the norms that since Watergate have really surrounded the interaction between the White House and the Justice Department. The document recommends eliminating the 10-year term for the FBI director, for example, so that the FBI director is accountable to the president who nominates them. Amanda, why is the Heritage Foundation's vision for the DOJ's new relationship with the White House troublesome to you?
Well, I would say since the post-Nixon era, there has been this idea that the Department of Justice should operate with some degree of independence. And there is growing conservative thought on the Trump-supporting side that this isn't true. We don't need independent agencies. But what that independence does, and it's largely reinforced by norms, by ethics lawyers and people who are committed to the rule of law and the idea that the president should not be interfering in political investigations. He should not be personally directing his prosecutors who they should investigate. And when you see Donald Trump on the campaign trail, on Truth Social, wherever he is constantly threatening investigations into his enemies, media outlets, journalists, accusing people who work for him that happen to oppose him of things like treason. And so when he has the ability with lawyers, so in the past, if you look at what happened in the 2020 election, there was that huge standoff at the Department of Justice in December 2020 when he was leaning on prosecutors to say, go investigate these conspiracy theories about election fraud. You know, let's have an investigation to keep this going. I'm summing this up. The department, this is another case where he was constrained by conservative lawyers in the Justice Department. They said, no, there's nothing to investigate here. We're not going to do this. They threatened to resign en masse. His handpicked Attorney General, Bill Barr, quit. Do you know how unusual it is for someone to resign in the last month of their term? And then he gave a statement to the press saying there was no widespread fraud in the election that would turn it. So this is another case where this wasn't the deep state sabotaging Donald Trump. These were people committed to the rule of law who wouldn't do his dirty work. And so in the second Trump administration, a bunch of people have gotten together and say, well, how do we eliminate that? How do we find people who will go along who are okay with the idea of a president interfering in political investigations? How do we get someone like Jeffrey Clark to be the new AG who in those days essentially said, sign me up. I'll go do this. Make me attorney general. I'll do it for you. I mean, these are all norms that you need a president to reinforce. You need a president who is committed to the idea that you're going to let the prosecutors exercise the law in a fair and equal way. Donald Trump rejects that. And you see him like every time he makes a speech, essentially saying, this is what I'm going to do. I believe him. I don't dismiss that rhetoric.
Mike, former President Trump's promised to appoint a special prosecutor to investigate and go after Joe Biden. He's threatened investigations on several former aides and officials who worked for him. Do you take him seriously? Should we take him seriously when he says he plans to use his constitutional powers in a second term as president for personal retribution?
I'm not a mind reader, but he promised the same thing about Hillary Clinton, and it never happened. So I don't, you know, but I can't even answer that because that's just a...
But should, I mean, the question is, should we take that seriously?
I don't take it seriously because he said that about Hillary Clinton and he never did that. You know, I'm not here to defend his rhetoric. I'm here to compare 3 years in office to 3 years in office.
Let's take, in the 3 years of office, he is now promising pardons, Amanda, you mentioned this earlier. He's promising pardons to some of the January 6th what he calls hostages,
right.
Criminals who have been prosecuted under the law and whether you believe that they have been fairly prosecuted or not. They've been prosecuted. They have been sentenced in many cases, hundreds of cases.
Hundreds, yeah.
Is there a corrosive effect to promising pardons to people who could then act illegally to pursue your own political ends?
Well, yeah, obviously, if you ask the question that way, I'm not sure that he's going to do that. You know, he promises many things on the campaign trail, like he did with Hillary Clinton, and that never happened. So I don't have a crystal ball. I can't look into that. I'm much better at comparing 3 years versus 3 years than forecasting the future.
Yeah. So your experience tells you that because he didn't do it previously, he wouldn't do it again.
Again, I don't have a crystal ball. I'm saying that I think we can compare 3 years versus 3 years, where we were in terms of economic growth, in terms of world peace, and where we are today.
Do you know anything?
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. As I mentioned, Donald Trump was constrained by people in his administration the first time around. A lot of people supporting Donald Trump's second term view that as a problem. Heritage 2025 is a big part of fixing that problem. They have a huge program devoted to finding and recruiting people who adopt this idea of unquestioned loyalty to the president and enacting his agenda throughout all of these federal agencies, not just the Department of Justice, not just the DHS, but we're talking like the FCC and everyone else. And I want to make it clear, the president does have every right to appoint his people and promote his policy agenda, but sort of just doing away with the idea that all these people should operate with a degree of independence, or that when Congress created these agencies and created the laws to run these agencies, that can somehow be tossed out. I mean, if you look at, this is so relevant right now with the first impeachment, which I think a lot of people, you know, was controversial. Should we do this? But it came down to a matter of Donald Trump essentially saying unilaterally, this money that Congress allocated for Ukraine, I'm going to hold up. Who constrained him? Oh, I don't know. People in Congress started wondering, why isn't Ukraine getting this aid, and starting looking into it. Now, I don't believe it's a proper use of executive authority to interfere with funds that Congress allocated. And then we saw what's happening in Ukraine now. I mean, this has disastrous results. So if you're looking at like the world on fire, I'm tremendously worried about how Donald Trump is going to destroy these European alliances and such. And that started with something that just had to do with the congressional allocation of money and how Donald Trump thought he could use his power to override it.
I'm going to get to our foreign alliances and foreign affairs in a moment. But I want to ask you, Mike, I want to let you respond to that. But I also want to ask you to just respond to the argument Amanda makes about the real resistance that Donald Trump faced wasn't from the deep state, but actually from well-placed conservatives within his own administration, like Mike Pence, like Bill Barr, like whom he appointed to serve out his agenda. How do you respond to that point from her?
Well, I do want to address this. I think that the reason the world is on fire today cannot be placed at the feet of Donald Trump. Has to be starting with the atrocious, you know, the English language ran out of adjectives to describe the Afghan pullout. It was of 2021. It
was. I think you'll probably find agreement on the stage about that.
Well, but I'm saying but the world is on fire today because Putin looks at this and says, right. Within weeks,
we're going to talk about NATO in a second. I want to just keep it. Can you respond to Amanda's point about the fact that the real resistance in Trump's first term wasn't from a deep state so much as from prominent conservatives in prominent positions in his own administration who drew the line and said no, like Bill Barr, the attorney general, like Mike Pence, the vice president, and many others, the FBI.
No, I would say that the real resistance came from the earlier
appointees, the DOD.
Like Tillerson, Mattis. Then after that, I think that the real resistance did not come from them. I would question that. I think it came from the bureaucracy. And it's not their place to question.
Can you give me an example or two?
Well, I mean, the first impeachment came from, you know, Vindman was not a career official. You know, he was not a political appointee. You know, we have to get career officials out of the policy making power. We need technical advice. We need scientific advice, but we cannot have a bureaucracy in which is making policy. If you're in a policy,
can I just ask a question? The policy was actually made by the Congress, who had allocated the funds to Ukraine, and so it wasn't this isn't about a national security staffer and Lieutenant Colonel Vindman. This was about the President of the United States redirecting congressionally appropriated funds to Ukraine. So why is that about the deep state?
Actually, the Congress, we want to see, I would like to see the executive, you know, not as powerful. I like to see the legislature have more power than it has right now. I think right now what we have is Congress is passing laws that begin the secretary shall, that allows for people who are supposed to be making, who are not supposed to be making policy, supposed to be rules and regulation in the bureaucracy. I don't think they should have a policy-making power. So I think that is what we would like to see change.
Another example of where the deep state thwarted Donald Trump rather than prominent conservatives in his administration, as Amanda suggested?
Let me think about it.
But there were
many instances where the real push came from the deep state, from the permanent.
I understand you're saying that, and you're going to think of another example for me. In the meantime, let me just ask you guys, I want to go to one more area that you actually don't write about in Protect Democracy, which is foreign policy. In the Authoritarian Playbook 2024, you stay on domestic policy, and where do you think Donald Trump's second term might unravel the institutions of our democracy? But I want to ask both of you, since you're both very fluent in these issues, about a recent suggestion Donald Trump made that would encourage Russia to attack NATO allies if they didn't increase their defense spending. And in the same breath, or in the next breath, Donald Trump discussed withdrawing from the NATO alliance. How would a second Trump presidency impact foreign policy, Amanda?
I mean, my mind is just replaying the tape of him standing in Helsinki after meeting with Putin during his first term and essentially rejecting the findings of our National Security Committee community in saying that, you know, they're about the 2016 election. And that has just been a carry through the whole way through. And what he is saying now, even though he isn't president, is already damaging. When he is floating the idea that if I am elected again, it's fine if Ukraine goes the way that any way that Russia wants it to go. And it concerns me from a democracy perspective, because, you know, I don't know if it doesn't matter whether it's terrorists attacking Israel or terrorists attacking Ukrainians. Genocide and slaughter is genocide and slaughter. And what we are witnessing with the Russian aggression against the Ukrainian people is just absolutely stomach curdling. And they have a chance to win this. All they want is American support. You know, and amazingly, through this time, NATO has become a stronger alliance, but we're on the precipice of all that going away in the next election if Donald Trump gets his way.
Mike, Heritage calls for the next president to, quote, transform NATO and increase the burden sharing with other countries that are part of the alliance, but not to abandon it.
Right.
What do you make of the rising isolationism on the right?
I think it's a response to overreach, first of all. I think it's probably a healthy response to overreach. But I want to say to Amanda, you're absolutely right that the October 7th, you know, attacks on Israel, the biggest slaughter of Jews since the Holocaust, all of that was caused because of Biden's weakness. It was Iran was encouraged to do it. Putin was encouraged to attack Ukraine. None of this happened. This is the area where we can best compare the 4 years to the 4 years.
But I think it's terrible, but I'm just going on the record quickly. I'm not going to lay that at Biden's feet.
But no, Putin did not invade a single inch of territory in the 4 years of the Trump administration. Sorry, it did not. All of a sudden, after Afghanistan, after that really despicable pullout, all of a sudden we have Putin invaded Ukraine. We have an Iranian proxy launching the atrocities that were committed on October 7th. Everyone knows them. We have China about to do the same thing with Taiwan. And I got news for you. you know, Maduro may be about to invade Guyana. They all have something in common. They're all allied with each other. All these other places, Guyana, Taiwan, Ukraine, and Israel are democratic. And this has all happened under Biden. Putin did not invade a single inch of territory under Trump. That's just a fact. We compare fact with fact.
Mike, how then do you respond to the highly congratulatory and affirmative remarks that President Trump makes of Xi Jinping, the supreme leader of China, the CCP, and of Putin, and of other autocrats around the world?
Yeah, I'm not here to defend his rhetoric. I'm here to defend a record of policy. And I'm here to say what we had for 4 years was world peace, and what we have right now is world mayhem.
I'm not so sure we had world peace, but take your point.
No, in the years of Trump, Putin invaded zero ground.
I know. I just wouldn't call it. I'm not so sure we'd go as far as saying world peace.
Today,
otherwise, like, kumbaya, let's just go back.
Compared to today?
But I recognize the point that you're saying we have had increasing escalations. And look, there's a real debate to be had about Joe Biden's foreign policy, for sure.
Yeah.
I want to move on.
What?
In 1974, on the original firing line, William F. Buckley Jr. invited his brother, then Senator James Buckley, to discuss the future of American conservatism in the aftermath of President Nixon's resignation. Take a look.
But first of all, I would say that the Watergate episode and others leading up to it, in very real senses, I think illustrate the fundamental conservative principle, and that is if you concentrate enough power, especially discretionary or arbitrary power, in any one place, at some point or another, it's going to be abused. And of course, there was nothing, this has been happening over the years. Now, yes, the Congress is now reasserting prerogatives, but I have, frankly, strong doubts as to whether or not the Congress can sustain this reassertion of its own theoretical equality, because of the simple fact that the Congress is so overloaded with scraps of work that it can't maintain its attention span.
Quick reaction, Amanda.
Well, it's just kind of interesting. They're talking about the reforms of the Watergate era, and sort of the thing that makes me sad that's happening in the Republican Party now is that I don't think they've learned the lessons of how abuse of power, conspiratorial thinking, weaponizing the Department of Justice and things like that, as we started the conversation, led to disastrous results, but just was a stain on the Republican Party for so long that had to be reclaimed. And finally, we got to those places. And now it seems like we want to go back and make the same mistakes.
Your reaction to what James Buckley said to
Well, first, I think we have a point of agreement between Amanda and me. And by the way, I really get along with Amanda. The weaponization of the Justice Department is awful, and that's what we've had under the last 3 years. He was a soothsayer, James Buckley. We had Congress does not legislate today. Congress has given away all its power. The power of legislation is now with the bureaucracy. We have to take it back and I don't want a strong executive. We want an executive in charge of the executive departments checked by a strong legislature which legislates. I don't want the legislative power to be in a fourth estate, in a fourth branch that does not exist in the Constitution.
Waiting for those examples.
Yes, you're right. But James Buckley was absolutely right.
We'll come back and do it again.
Yeah. Okay. I'd like to take some student questions now. Please introduce yourself and tell us your question.
My name is Julian Rocha. I'm a senior majoring in geography and global studies here at Hofstra. And my question is for the two of you. So if Donald Trump were to lose the election or be disqualified for any reason, do you think the future of the Republican Party lies with his proteges such as Marjorie Taylor Greene or with more, I guess, independent Republicans such as Glenn Youngkin?
I mean, I wish it were with someone like a Brian Kemp or a Larry Hogan and Nikki Haley. I would love to see her be the first female president. I think that would be amazing. But sadly, I don't think that's the case. If you looked at all the excitement that there was for Ron DeSantis for that moment to be sort of an heir to Trumpism, I think a lot of people looked at DeSantis and said, okay, you can follow the MAGA model, but they weren't saying that we like DeSantis because he's just this, he has new ideas, a new way of returning the Republican Party back to its roots in a traditional way. It's like, oh, he can do the executive power thing. He looks at Disney and says, your corporation spoke out against me and I'm going to bring a hammer at you. that's the stuff that animates the Republican base right now, and I don't see that going away.
Thank you for your question. I think that the conservative bench is deep, much deeper than the progressive bench. As we see right now, when questions are being asked, can Joe Biden really run in November? You don't have that many people. You have Gavin Newsom, you have Vice President Harris, who polls even lower than Joe Biden, and you have Whitmer, the governor of Michigan, and you don't really have the depth that you see on the Republican side.
Mike, Amanda gave some examples of people that she would like to see lead the Republican Party in a post-Trump era. Who do you like? You say the bench is so deep. Who do you like?
There's many. I agree with some of the names you mentioned, Amanda. I like DeSantis. I like, you mean not Trump, you mean?
Yeah. Do you think in a post-Trump era, to the student's question, the party ends up being led by Trump proteges like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Matt Gaetz?
J.D. Vance might be better.
And J.D. Vance. Or is it led by people like Nikki Haley?
I think there's a lot of depth to J.D. Vance. I think that Tim Scott is a prominent Republican.
Who do you think leads the party in a post?
I don't know that. I mean, I don't have a crystal ball. But in terms of
where the energy is in the conservative movement, does the conservative movement, is it fundamentally reshaped by Trump in a way that some of his ideological proteges, like a J.D. Vance, are more likely to lead the party forward? Or do you think it would be somebody more like a Nikki Haley who's run against Trump?
I really am so, we're talking about 4 years from now. So it's really hard. If we go back 10 years or even 4 years, it's very hard to predict that, Margaret. I mean, if you're asking me I could tell you the leaders who are there right now, and I named some. I put out, that's an impossible question to answer.
Then let's go to another student.
I am Alex Webb. I am a junior journalism student here at Hofstra. And my question for you is something that was already touched on a little bit. With political parties across the board getting more and more extremist with their views, do you think that Trump's role in these polarized politics as they exist today are something that's going to last in a post-Trump America?
Well, are you, and by the way, I was a journalism, I was a communications major as well. There's a great future for you. I think journalism is alive. I think what we're seeing today is exactly what you fear. The weaponization of government. I think we have that now. We don't have to wait until, let's see what happens in the next election. We have that already right now.
We just got to unpack that a little bit. How is the government weaponized now against citizens?
Well, they went after parents. You know, the White House was in cahoots with the National School Board Association. This has been demonstrated. They said, you know, they told them to use the powers that had been created for terrorist organizations. Parents who were standing up and asking to be heard in school board meetings, the Justice Department the Department of Education tried to stick the Department of Justice on them. That was really a weaponization of government.
Her question was about the future of political polarization. Do you think it will be better or worse after Donald Trump is no longer a national figure?
I think that having President Biden denigrate half the country as MAGA Republicans is not a healthy thing.
You don't like the phrase MAGA Republicans?
Wait, yeah. MAGA stands for America.
Yeah, but
great
he means
again.
It in a very derisive way. He means that they're deplorables. I think this.
No. But talk about the future of polarization.
I think we can lay it right now. What is happening right now? We have a president who denigrates half the country. This is not a unifier.
Okay. You mean President Trump or President Biden denigrates half the country?
Yeah.
Okay. What does the future of polarization in our politics look like 10 years from now?
Oh, wow. That's a really hard question. It's true. The most left-wing Republican was to the left of the most conservative Democrat. That's no longer the case. There's no Venn diagram. And that is a fact. I don't know how we get back this. I think conservatives are ready, if they ever get power back, to take back the culture, to their things that have become norms that should not have been norms 10 years ago, that have been become norms over the last 10 years. So I think we're going to remain polarized. I'm sorry.
You're not hopeful.
Yeah, I'm not hopeful. And I don't think that we should be at a kumbaya moment right now. I think that we need to solve some issues about where the country should go.
Is there a way to do that by building consensus? Or does it have to be
in a democracy, you need to build consensus. In a democracy, you know, eventually there's going to have to have some compromise, especially in Congress. But it has to be, we have to be moving in a certain direction. And that I think, especially on the cultural issues, we have to, the fence that has been moved so far this way has to be moved back a little bit. Not a little bit, a lot.
I mean, I guess, to be honest with you, Margaret, I have a hard time envisioning what a post-Trump Republican Party looks like. I mean, this is, again, the third time that Donald Trump has been on the ballot in the face of devastating losses. And so, you know, seeing how there really wasn't a robust challenge to him in this primary. Okay, so he loses this election. What's to stop him from running again in 2028? And if he does win the election, A, there's questions about whether he'll leave. But
Father
number two,
time.
That because, yeah, okay, we're not going to get into the other circumstances that could arise.
But he's 77 years old. I mean, this is, you know, the clock goes in one direction.
Right, but I would say that the lesson, whether he has some kind of unforeseen circumstance or he wins, the lesson that the Republican Party will draw is that that is the way that we win, through this divisive, just animate the base, turn out your vote. You don't have to compromise. You don't have to reach out to the other side of the aisle. You don't even have to have a big tent inside the Republican Party, because let's be honest, you know, I'm pretty committed conservative. I'm not welcome. No one is asking for my vote when I talk about how we need to limit executive power. What they say to conservatives like me, what Donald Trump says to someone like Nikki Haley, you are barred. Get out. Okay. I guess we'll go.
That's not what I say to you, Amanda.
No, you don't.
Okay.
I know.
You want to run for president?
We feel the love, and this is where we actually do have the ability to model having civil discourse and believing that that is our civic responsibility. Mike Gonzalez, Amanda Carpenter, thank you very much for coming here to discuss your vision and your interpretation of what a Trump 2.0 administration would look like. And to the students of Hofstra University, thank you for joining us.